Welcome to the Social Impactors Podcast. This podcast is all about impact. We work to highlight impactful individuals making positive social change in their communities. From coaches, authors, entrepreneurs, influencers, we tap into the minds of some of the most impactful people around the world to find out how they have built a life of creating impact. Now listen in and be ready to go on a journey of enlightenment, motivation, and awe. Social impact everywhere.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Social Impactors Podcast. And today we have a very special guest. We have Kevin Cutler, and Kevin is another Ontarian. He's actually from a town called Huntsville, which is about an hour from where I am. And he is a trainer and facilitator for the International Institute for Restorative Practice Canada, which is super, super interesting. And I'm really excited to delve into what that is. But I want to first start off with saying, you know, thank you for taking time today to have this conversation with me. Even though it's only 30 minutes of time, there's a lot that can be talked about and a lot of knowledge that can be shared. So thank you for taking that time today.
Thank you for having me.
And so, Kevin, I'd love to jump into, you know, a little bit about who you are, what you do, and why you believe you're a social impactor.
Well, that's a great question. And I think I'll start with my background. I haven't always been doing what I'm doing now. my first career, when I didn't make it to the NHL.
Every Canadian's dream.
I know. I stopped growing when I was 16, and that pretty much nailed it at that point. But I was an educator for over 30 years. And I went from the role of teacher to administrator to school administrator as a principal and district level administrator, looking after things like special education and other special projects. And then I became a superintendent. I did a 2-year stint with provincial schools, which, if people are not familiar with that, are schools that work for students that are deaf and hard of hearing, blind, low vision, and with profound learning disabilities. So, you know, over that time, I had the opportunity to evolve not just in my practice, but also in my beliefs in terms of working with young people and their families and the community as well, and staff. And what I learned over that time dealing with difficult situations, and one of my primary responsibilities before I retired from public education was dealing with serious acts of harm and discipline in schools. And what I learned, probably the hard way, was that the punitive, or what was termed certainly in the late 90s, primarily in the U.S., zero tolerance approach or belief is not effective. It doesn't meet the needs of those who have been harmed, those who have caused harm, and ultimately the community itself, whether it be a school or a community or jurisdiction in general. So during my final years, I became aware of restorative practice through staff at Trillium Lakelands District School Board who had been to a workshop. And I was very, very impressed by the material and the approach, but mostly the philosophy and the belief system that underpins what it is we'll be talking about today, that really restorative practice is not a program. It's a way of thinking and being. So the actual social impact is not necessarily in terms of just what you do, but more about what you believe and what it is you're trying to achieve in working with people. And it has huge applicability to everything, anything that has to do with relationships, whether it's the education sector, the business sector. When we look at what's going on nationally with truth and reconciliation, when we look at, you know, the political discourse that's happening worldwide right now, and the divisiveness that seems to be occurring within communities, the lack of engagement because of social media, you know, a lot of what we teach and what we talk about really has an impact on the way people think, which ultimately then has impact on the way they behave.
And I'm curious to just kind of delve into a little bit about, you know, the transition from being in the school system, being in the education system, and then jumping into restorative practices. Do you think that a lot of what you're doing now can translate very much into what we do through, you know, traditional education? Maybe it's just more personally for myself, but I find there's a lot missing in that sense, right? Through traditional education.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if you've ever had the opportunity to read Peter Senge, he talks about us having mental models of things.
Yeah.
And you know, we all have a mental model of schoolness. And that model kind of has permeated certainly Western society for decades, if not centuries, and that we respond to things in the way we always have, thinking it would make a difference.
Yeah,
it's only in recent years I think that we look at the actual impact, because you know, sending somebody on their way when they're 16 years old, knowing they're going to find a decent job somewhere because they can't play school very well, is really old thinking. Yet we continue to see practices in a lot of parts of society that support that notion as far-fetched as it actually is right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having the opportunity to work primarily in schools, training in restorative practice, I'm able to bring a lot of my own background and experience and, you know, have tough conversations with people and say, you know what, I've been where you are, and I've done the things that are happening right now. And I can tell you that if I could have known this 30 years ago, it would have been different. And so what we know now is that really what has the most impact on people in terms of their behavior and ultimately how productive they are, whether it be in school or at work, has nothing to do with the fear of punishment or even necessarily the pursuit of tangible rewards. It really has more to do with relationships. And the better job that we do building community anywhere, the more likely we are going to achieve those things.
That's an interesting perspective. I like that. It's something that I've always believed in for the longest time too. And it's something that I see becoming more, maybe more evident, right? In modern times and what we do, there is definitely a flip from, you know, traditional approaches to what we hope would be a little bit more holistic in the future. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Do you see that happening as well?
You know, like I spend a lot of time reading articles on platforms such as LinkedIn, and I'm finding that more of the certainly respected writers in terms of leadership, this is what they're saying now. Some of them have been saying it for years. I mean, if you look at somebody like Richard Branson, for instance.
Yeah, he's been saying it forever.
It's true. Saying it forever. And now people are listening. And you know, and if you read Daniel Goleman in terms of emotional intelligence, I mean, this is not new stuff, but suddenly people are paying attention. People are getting training to enhance their skills in that area. And that, you know, the whole movement in wellness and mindfulness and, you know, dealing with issues in workplaces around toxic culture and bullying. I mean, this is what it's all about. And, you know, having had the opportunity to deal with conflict, serious conflict in workplaces, you know, it's tragic, I think, in some instances of what people have to go through emotionally and psychologically just to earn a living. And
yeah, that's true.
And I think the, you know, another big part of what we teach and what we believe in is that there are explicit practices that we can do as leaders and managers, or even as parents, around fair process that make all the difference in the world if you go into it with an intentional mindset of of that, yeah, I'm going to deal with this in a fair way. But, you know, ultimately, I'm going to make a decision. I have to make a decision. That's what I do. But people are going to feel that they've been engaged in the process, that they understand the reasons for any decision, and that finally they understand what's expected of them once the decision's been made.
It's true. So what about community then? I'm interested in your perspective on this. How are you with everything that you're doing through your restorative practices and everything that you've done throughout your life? How are you making a positive impact then in your community, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what it comes down to is giving people the real an opportunity for real dialogue.
Yeah.
Not bantering issues about on social media. I don't know what your experience with that is. I gave up a while ago ever commenting on any post that anybody has made that I would find distasteful or...
Yeah, there's no point. No point.
You find yourself being attacked more. The comments you receive are pretty caustic from people that you don't even know. Yeah. And it's like, this is not a conversation, even though, you know, the internet has great potential for that, and so does social media. It really falls short in terms of that. So how do you create a safe forum for people to come together and facilitate it in such a way that they feel like they've been heard, they've had a chance to tell their story, but they've also had a chance to listen to others? So IIRP is an international organization. And we've held forums worldwide in communities to deal with things like migration, for instance, bringing refugees and community members together to have conversations about what's true and what's not and what's real and how people are affected by things that are going on. And there have been instances where we've had circles, and we use that construct a lot, and we teach people how to use that construct, which is another impact that we have.
Yeah.
Bringing together people who have been involved in hate crimes with the people that they've harmed, to talk about not just, you know, how they affected others, but for people to hear their story as well. And it's amazing the learning that happens, but also the change that happens at that point. So when I teach people how to do that effectively, and a lot of, you know, what we teach is grounded in practices and philosophies of indigenous communities all over the world. And I've done a fair bit of work in the Canadian Arctic and Northern Quebec. And it's interesting to work with indigenous communities because in terms of doing something like running circles, I learn as much from them as they do from me, maybe more. So when I go somewhere and people learn this skill, it's something they can use in their family. It's something they can use in their workplace. It's something they can use in their classroom or their club or their organization, where people then feel engaged and real communication happens at that point. And all of the different, subjective assumptions that we make about each other go out the window at that point, once we hear people's real stories.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, whenever you put some, a face to something or a face to a challenge or give someone, you know, a little bit of a soapbox to really explain that, it changes everything. Because then that's that human-to-human connection. You're not, it's not just, a internet or a social media problem. You're actually creating a human-to-human connection. And I think that's a really, missed element in a lot of things. Again, I agree, social media, I like to think of it from a positive perspective, that social media has great opportunity and, can be a great connector. But again, like you said, there's also those channels where it can't be. And when you give this, like you said, this positive dialogue, it changes everything. It's now I'm a human connecting to you. And it's very hard to be negative when you know there's a human on the other side rather than just a keyboard, let's say.
Right. And I excuse me. And I think the the psychological premise that, and I'm not a psychologist, but
I'm not either.
some of the theories that support our work are around affect script psychology, which basically means that we're hardwired to respond to the affects that other people are showing us as we're interacting with them, which is completely different than email, social media, anything like that. Even one step above what we're doing right now, although this is certainly superior to not being able to see each other, but the expression that you just made has an effect on me and what I say and what I think and what I do. And that when as young as an infant, we respond to the facial expressions of adults, and they do the same. So when we're sitting in a circle having dialogue with people and they see our expressions, we're hardwired to naturally want to make things better. And that is why, one of the main reasons why, that in even some of the most difficult circumstances I've been involved in, people are able to come to agreements about how things can be better and moving forward. It doesn't mean that they become friends or associates at that point. It means they have a clear understanding and moving forward about what things are going to look like from that point on. And people will sometimes criticize in a school setting, for instance, that when harm is caused, rather than just kick somebody out of school forever, that we do this. This is not an easy way out for them. Sometimes students would say, I would rather you kick me out of school for 10 days than, send me away for a shorter period of time and then have this forum where I actually have to face the people I've affected, including my own family. And it's not just a free for all. It's very, very professionally facilitated. There's extensive training involved in being able to do this, and a series of questions that we ask, to make sure that the process is fair. And one question we never ask, can you guess what it is?
No, you tell me.
Okay. So think about if somebody does something or a child does something, we generally walk up to them and we ask the question, why did you do that?
The simple question. Yeah, the why. It's always the hardest to say.
And when you think about it, either you don't get an answer, or they can't answer it, or if you do get one, it's not what you're wanting to hear.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's, because I wanted to.
Right. And so people become defensive automatically when we ask that question. And also, it's making the assumption from the person posing the question that that person has demonstrated some malice and should be feeling some guilt over the event, even though what we're assuming may not be the case at all.
Oh.
So the question that we ask everybody involved, we have a series of questions. The first one is, what happened? So that gives people the opportunity to tell their story. And then a very important question we ask next is, what were you thinking at the time? Mm. And then we ask, what have you been thinking about since? And then we ask, well, who has been affected and how? And finally, we ask, okay, what can be done to make things better? And people are much more responsive to that set of questions than, okay, tell us why.
Yeah.
And quite often when you hear of an act of harm in the media, they'll always say, and no reason is given as to why the van was driven into a crowd of people. There's a very good chance the person probably can't answer that in a coherent way. They could possibly answer the other questions. The questions that we ask people who have been harmed are very similar, but we also ask the question, what has been the hardest thing for you? What has been the hardest thing for you? And then we finally ask them, what can be done to make things better? So it's important that somebody who has harmed someone else hears the answers to those, because quite often the realization they have is it goes well beyond anything that they experienced with that person as well.
So I'm curious about this perspective then, because we've talked a lot about the individual. We've talked a lot about what we can do, you know, one-on-one or help these situations, but let's translate that then into business. And I want to know your opinion on, is social impact an important part of business? And if so, why? Why is that important to you?
Yeah, great question. And I'd say it is emerging into that direction, that I think corporations, large or small, are cognizant of their impact or the impact they should be having on the communities in which they serve, that the people within their employ, their lives go beyond the doors of their institution, and that other things that are happening have an impact on the psyche of people as they interact during the day, for sure. And that what is important and true and real and important outside of the workplace is just as or more inside of the workplace. And if people are generally unhappy or feeling unsafe or feeling unfulfilled in general, it's not likely the time they spend in the workplace is going to be the other side of the coin for them. So why not address the elephant in the room, that and take on the realization that we are, as employers or as institutions, at least partially responsible for the wellness of the people who devote a lot of their time to us and to their institutions, and have those conversations and give opportunities for those conversations to happen. If there's divisiveness in a community over an issue, it's gonna find its way into the workplace as well.
Yeah.
And you know, it creates camps, it creates division. And that, you know, we constantly, I know as a former superintendent, constantly having to model the kind of behavior that we want from everyone in terms of how we deal with conflict. And conflict finds its way into every nook and cranny, and it's not necessarily a bad thing unless it's handled in a very unproductive or destructive way. So creating a culture, creating processes, creating understandings of how we deal with that in a fair, transparent way is social innovation and social impact at that point. Because those are the skills that we take from the workplace to the community, and it moves back and forth.
I liked what you said about you know, when a community is divisive, it leaches into everything. It's true, right? And people devote their majority of their days to their organizations or their institutions, and sometimes even more than family, right? Like if you're a 9 to 10 hour shift, you're spending more time with your colleagues in the institution than you do sometimes your family. And if there's a challenge there, it is just inherent that you might take that personally, right? Or if that divisiveness is there, it's hard to get away from, or hard to be kind of rational in that, because you're consumed by it, because it's your everyday problem. So I've been in some settings where there's been divisiveness, and it leaches. And if you can get to the core of the holistic problem of that, it's much better than you know, just letting it slide or finding, you know, a little bit of a band-aid effect. You have to do these restorative practices to really get to the root cause of what's creating that divisiveness.
And some of what happens is, you know, people are very susceptible to shame. And, you know, I don't know if you've been reading Brené Brown's work recently. She talks a lot about shame, and certainly it's one of the underpinnings of what we do as well. And that, you know, in those certain situations, people respond in different ways in terms of what we call a compass of shame, where there's 4 points. And so one of those points could be just to withdraw.
Yeah.
That I don't leave my cubicle, I don't eat lunch with other people, because I'm not feeling safe, or I'm feeling like I've done something wrong, or I'm not worthy enough to be there with others. Or I can attack myself at the same time and say, you know what, I suck, I'm not good at this, I don't belong here. Or I can attack others, and that happens quite often. or I can do what's called avoidance. And that's different than withdrawing because there's actual destructive behaviors attached to that, like addiction, for instance.
Yeah.
To a number of things, including video games. So if we see that happening in our group and we choose not to address it, but we know it's there, then overall that's negligence.
Yeah.
And so how do we create a safe space for those conversations to happen? Even if it doesn't necessarily mean at the end of it all, we're going to agree on everything except for how we're going to interact from this point on. And that is a big part of what we teach. How would I, in any setting, bring people together to do this? And it's important.
Yeah. And I'm the last question, I'd love to jump into it because you have, you know, a wealth of knowledge on these restorative practices and how to help with these challenges that you might experience, you know, at home or in the workplace. What's your advice then for others to begin building that, I want to say impact, not just social impact, but that impact in their communities? And maybe, you know, it's people suffering from these, you know, divisiveness sometimes, or maybe short-term or long-term. What's your advice for them to begin building that impact?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question, because, you know, not everybody wants to jump into a training session to do things.
Yeah.
Really, it is about relationships. And I ask the question quite often in my workshops, I ask people, what keeps you awake at night?
Good question.
And, you know, no matter what they say, it always comes back to relationships.
Yeah.
So I think the first piece of advice I would give people is, from a completely non-judgmental standpoint, describe the relationships that you see in your family without assigning any blame, in your family, in your community, in your workplace, in your group, whatever. What is it you're observing? What is it you're hearing? Who talks to who socially and not? And then the second thing I would suggest to people is that they do take the time to look at materials such as from IRP about what restorative practice is, that sort of thing. What are some of the, you know, philosophical things that people say about why these dynamics are there, and then understanding the reason for those dynamics, and then think about, okay, how can I have an impact there? How can I create a safe space? What does that look like? What's the construct? What questions would I ask? Excuse me. Start small, but think big. And knowing that the best forum to do this is, as it has been for thousands of years, a circle. And learning how to facilitate a circle is a key skill that you can use in meetings, family groupings, friends, community groups, you name it. Anytime people come together, what do? We get in a circle. So if you learn an explicit practice to make good conversation happen for everybody in that circle, and a way to form questions so that when we leave the circle, we all have a clear understanding of what it looks like at this point, then you're on your way at that juncture.
I liked what you said about start small, think big. I like that. Yeah. It's true. Yeah. And I was thinking about, you know, every setting I've been in, you know, whether work or even just like friends and dinners, we're always kind of in a, you know, whether an elongated or a weird circle, it always is a circular pattern. I was trying to think, you know, the reasons, and it's super inviting. You can see everyone from the table. Everyone has a chance to speak and be seen and heard. That's awesome. And I never thought about just how powerful that setting can be. It really is.
And we're, again, like I mentioned before, we're hardwired to seek that out. That is how we feel like we belong and that we're an equal player in that setting. And, you know, even for children, they see a group of adults standing in a circle. What do they want to do? They want to get in there.
Yeah, be a part of it. Sometimes right in the middle.
And so the skill facilitation part of that is, how do you ensure that everybody has a chance to speak? So using something in an actual setting where you're facilitating something like a talking piece, for instance, and creating norms in that circle that only the person who is holding this talking piece should speak at that point, and then agreeing whether we're going to pass it around clockwise or counterclockwise, and that if I'm facilitating, I'm not making a comment on everything that is said, and that people have, they have the right to pass if they don't want to say anything, and that's fine. So, you know, if you venture into schools, for instance, now this is quite a common way of having dialogue in a classroom now, more so than it was certainly when I was in school. You know, if there was a circle when I was in school, we were probably playing dodgeball. So, I think, you know, the powerful thing for me being able to do this with, particularly with young people, is certainly for a lot of students in schools where this has been implemented, this is all they know. To them, this is their mental model of school. And that it begins with a circle and it ends with a circle, and we have dialogue when there's a problem. And that when they become our leaders and when they become our teachers and our parents and our community leaders and our business leaders, then this is the way they're going to do things. And to me, that's social impact.
I like that. Kevin, I want to thank you for taking time to be on the podcast today. You know, that was an incredible, 30 minutes of just really good knowledge. And I say this a lot, you know, super unique perspective, but I think I mean it more than anything right now, because it's emerging, but you're also really holistically changing things. And I think that the more and more that we do these practices that are holistic and these practices that actually solve the source of the problem, we'll just become better and better and better at what we do. So again, Kevin, I just want to say, you know, thank you so much for being on the podcast with me.
Thank you for having me.